Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Chase Thomas podcast, where I'm still the aforementioned Chase Thomas, coming to you live from Knoxville, Tennessee. Everything School HQ up there in
New York City.
It's not Fangraphs Zone. John Taylor. John, good evening, sir. How are you?
I would love to have someone chart for us, like, how consistent the New York City is for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what, you know, what does it sound like? How does it work? Like, am I really getting it every week? But I am good here in New York. Where baseball remains a thing. Mm-hmm. Where everybody's elbows are, like, we had that moment last week, right, where we did the whole the Pets' heads are falling off.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's elbows are exploding. It's a problem. It's not great.
And you listen to smart people like Verlander talk about how to fix it, and you're like, oh, that's not something that fixes anything for decades, but he's right. But it's like, okay, if we follow that thing, then it's going to require a long-term investment and getting a lot of people on the same page that I don't necessarily think is possible.
Yeah, there are a lot of threads, a lot of ins, a lot of outs to the whole MLB exploding elbows crisis, which... to your point, and to Justin Verlander's point, there are so many interlinked issues that it's not simply, and you know, I understand from a level of due diligence why the MLBPA, especially because it seems like it's been an issue for the players since it was announced and implemented, you know, why the MLBPA would immediately say this is because of the pitch clock. That's not the case. There's just no way you're ever going to be able to draw a one-to-one correlation between pitch clock makes the game go faster. Oh no, everybody's elbows are hurting.
Yeah.
But it's definitely part of it. And, you know, it speaks, I think, in particular to how complicated the issue is. That it's part of it, but it's not just the one thing.
Yeah.
You can't just the whole thing, everything with the way that baseball now exists in terms of the way the game is played is. You know, it's a domino effect. You topple one thing, and a thousand others go toppling right in its wake. So,
yep.
I don't know if you wanted to jump right into the exploding elbows thing.
Well, we'll get to the exploding elbows.
Because my take would basically be that, like, Jordan Lyles is the starter of the future. It's just we've got a completely 180 it now. Everybody now needs to throw no harder than 92 at any given point.
Jimmy Moyer is just like in charge of watching every starter around the league.
We're bringing back the Brett Tomko days. We're bringing back Woody Williams. We're bringing back Sean Estes. We're bringing back the soft toss and control specialists. That's the mode and model of pitcher that needs to come back. But in all seriousness, and I, you know, the with the elbows and the rash of Tommy John injuries we've had just recently, what with Shane Bieber going down, your boy Spencer Strider likely going down. Who was the reliever who just blew out as well?
Josiah Gray.
Josiah Gray might have an elbow issue. Nick Pivetta. It looks like his UCL is okay, but went on the injured list with a flexor strain. Obviously, to say nothing of, you know, losing Garrett Cole before the season, although he does not require full Tommy John. Lucas Giolito, who blew out before the season.
Yep.
Jonathan,
and then you
Weiss,
have weird anomalies like Aroldis Chapman is throwing 102 at age 30. What is he now?
As someone on Twitter pointed out with regards to Chapman, it's like Aroldis Chapman has figured out how to throw hard and not hurt your arm. It's be 6'4" and 235 pounds of pure muscle, Mm-hmm. And when you pitch, your whole body is just one giant torque.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, it's,
it doesn't seem something that other pitchers can model after.
No,
and be
no,
like,
it's,
yeah,
it's let's a good just reminder, do this. For as much as we rag on Aroldis Chapman, and deservedly so,
yes,
he is an absolute freak of nature when it comes to his body. There, you know, he is not, he is the exception, not the rule to all this.
Yep.
The rule is that, well, the rule is generally that pitchers break. The act of throwing a baseball over and over again at high speed with the immense precision and control and command needed to be a major league player, more likely than not will end up hurting your arm because it is just, it is a repetitive motion executed at extreme, effort and velocity. But I should also note too, that for as many Tommy John injuries as we've had just in the last week, again, the Bieber and Jonathan Loaisiga was the other name I was trying to think of, the Yankees reliever who also is going to need Tommy John, probably Strider, it looks like, in all likelihood, although the Braves are understandably slow playing it as much as they can, I think, to try to figure out any possible alternative solution. Fingers crossed, but I don't think they're going to get the news they want there. It's worth noting, too, that, and this is something I picked up from Travis Sawchuk on Twitter, formerly of 538, and the Score. I believe he's no longer at the Score, but either way. April, this chunk of April, these first 6 weeks of the year, are almost always when we have our biggest run of Tommy John injuries or of elbow injuries, be it flexor strains, inflammation, tears, because, you know, this is the first month that these guys are throwing pitches in anger after the offseason.
Yeah.
You know, the ramp up period, particularly as guys start either adding velocity or throwing harder because of something they did in the offseason. Bieber is a great example of someone who went to driveline in the offseason, came into the spring throwing much harder than he had in years previous. Was holding that velocity up until I believe, well, he'd only made two starts. I believe he was holding that velocity in both starts and then clearly hurt himself in the process. It is just kind of expected that in the first 6 weeks of the season, this is when you would see the largest number of guys suffer arm injuries because those are guys who are ramping up, who are, again, throwing hard and throwing live in live game action, non-spring in games that matter for the first time since September in some cases, October in others. But at the same time, you know, and this is going to Justin Verlander's comments, and I think the comments of a lot of players who the pitchers have spoken as well, the way the game is incentivized as a pitcher, which is to say you are throwing max effort pretty much every pitch because you are trying to put as much velocity on that pitch as possible. Additionally, with as high spin as you can, and the way that the game has evolved in terms of the technology behind pitching and the ability to do pitch modeling, the ability to go to a place like driveline and essentially design the perfect pitch and then execute it, that does not seem conducive to the long-term health of pitchers. Mm-hmm. And again, pitching is not something where most guys are not Nolan Ryan or Greg Maddux or Randy Johnson did get hurt. But yeah. Most guys in particular are not Nolan Ryan or Greg Maddux where they just pitch forever. Those guys are unique. That's why they're partially why they're Hall of Famers. Most guys do not have that kind of ability to stay healthy like that. But the way pitching is designed now almost seems encouraged to hurt guys more quickly.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that you're throwing with premium velocity, because of the fact that you're throwing hard spin stuff that does the most damage to your ligaments, a lot of breaking stuff. The sweeper, obviously, that's become extremely popular, which is just the huge horizontal sweep slider. There's just no real way around that. And again, particularly when teams are selecting for it. You know, this isn't just something where baseball pitchers just started throwing harder. This is something where the league and its teams, or the teams in particular, because the league only follows, teams in trying to win the most games or at least be the best team they can or at least the most efficient team they can have all landed on, we need pitchers who do this. You know, there's a reason why it seems like every other reliever in the league throws 95 at the slider. You know, there's a reason you see guys like Spencer Strider or Jared Jones on the Pirates, whose only repertoire is huge, hard fastball, high, big slider. And yeah. That's, you know, that is what major league teams want. Of course, they want pitchers who have durability, command, control, pitchability, who can execute multiple pitches. But just that combo of velocity and hard spin alone is valuable. It's what teams select for, and because the numbers prove over and over again, hitters have a harder time with that. The best way to get hitters out is to throw hard and with a lot of spin,
right?
One or both, in most cases with most pitchers, both. You know, there's a reason that Spencer Strider was the best pitcher in baseball before he got hurt, because he did those two things better than probably anyone else in the league. Similarly, there's a reason why a guy like Noah Syndergaard, when his velocity fell from 99 to, you know, 93, 94, whatever it was, and he lost, post elbow injury, he lost some of the, I think, kind of the spin on the slider, went from a potential front of the rotation ace to a dude who is effectively out of baseball.
Yeah.
Actually, kind of wild to think about. He was a free agent this offseason, and just nobody signed him. There wasn't even, I don't think we even saw one single Noah Syndergaard rumor over the course of the winter. This is a pitcher's league, first and foremost, and it is a league currently built on power, which is to say velocity and spin. And that's just going to tear elbows up. There's no way around that, you know, and there's nothing. This isn't something either with the league, like with the pitch clock. It's like, oh, we want to make the games faster. Okay, well, let's speed up some of the action in between. There's nothing that the league is not going to come out and say, okay, nobody throw hard anymore. That's simply not realistic. Similarly, no team is going to give up that advantage willingly until and unless they just run out of pitchers. And as we've already seen with some franchises, and the Rays, the ones who come immediately to mind, most teams don't seem to care. You know, the Rays currently have three pitchers on the injured list recovering from some elbow injury or another: Shane McClanahan, Jeffrey Springs, and Drew Rasmussen. I think all three of them have are recent Tommy John recipients.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter to them because it's the Rays, they can find pitching seemingly anywhere. But you know, it's also just a matter. But that's what works, you know. And especially if it's something where it's like, you know, it's one thing if Blake Snell blows out, you know, on a long term contract. It's one thing if Yoshinobu Yamamoto blows out. It's another thing when it's Jeffrey Springs and he's making all of, well, I think he just signed an extension, maybe Rasmussen. I think both of them did. It's another thing when it's a pitcher making the league minimum. You know, what do you really care? And if a guy doesn't come back from that, guess what? Every minor league system has 100 dudes in it who could conceivably throw 95 at the plus slider. There is an inexhaustible supply of bodies. And while it might start to feel at a certain point like, okay, maybe there aren't that many bodies. Maybe there is actually a point at which we have to do something, because otherwise the quality level of pitching generally is going to go down because not enough of these guys are capable of doing this long term. I think the other side of that is, well, maybe then the game just evolves into something different at this point. Because again, if there's no way for the league, and I don't think it's not at all realistic for Rob Manfred to come out and say, no more hard sliders. You know, that's just not a thing that the league has any interest in doing. And teams aren't necessarily going to give up the advantage they have in having those pitchers, then we are probably going to get to a point, or maybe not get to a point, where we're going to reach this kind of conflict point of, well, then what is a pitcher going to be going forward? Because you cannot realistically expect, and I think we're starting to see this in action, a guy who throws the way Spencer Strider does be able to have the kind of length, durability, or career that older pitchers did, unless he markedly like changes the stuff. But if he changes the stuff,
he's not going to do that, because it's going to derail a bunch of these guys' careers that got paid. You can't fix the guys who are already in the majors. And I think that's what Verlander's talking about. Is like, you can't fix it for these guys. You can't fix Shane Beamer now. Like, that's
not only can you not fix Shane Beamer, but to your point, like, if you're a guy like Strider who got to where he is because of how hard he throws his fastball, because of how good his slider is, when you come back from your elbow injury, you're not going to think to yourself, oh, okay, well, the solution is, instead of throwing 98 all the time, I'm just going to throw 93. Guess what? You're a worse pitcher now.
Yep.
It is like the margin of error.
It's still in their best interest to be on the shelf for a while and get paid and then bounce back and keep throwing that and hope it doesn't happen again for a while.
Pretty much.
And you get the next contract.
And I think that's because, again, the incentives around the league for both teams and players are max effort, high spin, you know, because that is what's been shown to work. And until and unless some team does something different or manages to figure out a different way to do this, I think the more likely outcome is teams are going to start trying to figure out, okay, well, what does this mean for pitching development going forward if we know that these arms now have a shelf life that's even shorter than what we'd already assumed they would be? Because I assume most every team goes into this assuming, you know, no pitcher is going to last forever. We're only going to have this guy useful and functional for X number of seasons. That number now seems to be going down because you can't really expect these guys with the arsenals they have to stay healthy or be durable for as long as you'd like to be. So does that mean we're going to get to a point where every team just starts doing bullpen games because that's the only way to make this work? is to have these guys go all
well,
out.
That's bad for the sport because that's you're going to lose people. Like that's well, you don't.
But you're losing people already. Yuri Perez, for example, the Marlins basic had him on the Strasburg style, like pitch counts, rest days. You're going to the minors for a month not to pitch to keep his elbow as structurally sound as possible, and he still blew out.
Yeah,
there is no way to prevent. I'm going to sound like that Onion headline about mass shootings. No way to prevent this as only nation in the world where this regularly happens. There's no way to prevent UCL injuries. At least there's no way to guarantee that a pitcher will not blow his elbow out. The only way I assume, and you know, not a doctor, I think it would be great if someone were to reach out to, and I think people have, but to reach out to the various orthopedic surgeons who work in baseball to be like, what is the medical and physiological solution here? But I would guess that every doctor is going to tell you the same thing. These guys have to throw less. They have to throw not as hard, not as much spin, not as much generally. Like there just needs to be less or else arms are going to wear out. You know, it's just the reality. We have hit, I think, the physiological limit of how hard a human being can throw a baseball.
Well, maybe we do that. Like you said, maybe the fix is like, instead of trying to fix these guys, it's like you do 10-man rotations.
Basically. And I think that's where teams would probably want to go anyway, because that's also cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
If you're, you know, a starter who throws 200 innings is the most valuable thing in baseball. But in a version of the game where every starter throws 50 innings a year, you know, yeah, some of those guys are going to be more valuable than others, but...
But here's the downside of that. Guess who's going to hate that?
Fan.
The starters. Like the ones who are really good, the ones who actually differentiate themselves. They're like, wait, whoa. Then you're destroying their value. So it's
And there's a lot to be said, just purely on an aesthetics level, about the way Major League Baseball has moved away from the starting pitcher as kind of the star of the show.
Yeah.
The fact that starting pitchers nowadays complete fewer innings than ever. There are probably more of them than there ever have been at this point in time. And then you see, it makes it all the more painful when a guy like Strider or Perez or Bieber or Cole or whoever it is gets hurt and is suddenly gone.
Yeah.
As
cool as it is that Ronaldo Lopez comes out to the Halloween theme song as his walkout music.
Very strange. And I would like to have a serious conversation with him and a lot of other people about it.
But I mean, as cool as that is, you still want your...
Starters. You want and it's important too because that's also been such a big part of the narrative of the game pretty much since baseball started. The starter has always had a preeminent, prominent role in not just the game, but also the story of baseball itself. And now, given where we are, where starting pitching seems to be just breaking the very players who do it, it does make you wonder, okay, well, what is next? Because it's not gonna be speed limiters, you know, it's not gonna be the equivalent of putting
it's at the youth level. I think it's like what Verlander's talking about. It's the youth level.
Teaching kids a safer way to pitch. But unfortunately, again, the reality is a safer way to pitch is probably a less efficient way to pitch.
Yes.
And so is MLB ready to... I think that's kind of the choice before baseball. It's two things. You can either have guys keep pitching the way they're pitching, and we're going to keep seeing this happen probably more often where these guys blow out because they're throwing too hard. And you're going to end up in this place where starting pitching essentially turns into the current state of NFL quarterbacks, where it's like there are five dudes who are really, really good at it.
Yeah.
And then a rotating cast of guys where every day you're going, huh? Who the hell is this? Like, or there has to be some change. And like you said, and like Verlander said, at the ground level, the youth level, because as Verlander also noted, there's nothing you can do about the guys who are already in the majors.
Nope.
They're here because of how they pitch. You're not going to change that. But at a youth level, at Little League, travel ball, high school, college, to figure out to make it, and I don't know what that even is that needs to be done.
They all have to get together. Like coaches have to get together. There have to be clinics. There have to be, I mean, agents, and there has to be like a unanimous, like maybe Major League Baseball send something out to them where it's like, this is what we're looking for the future. This is what we want. This is where we're going to be transitioning to. Of like, hey, like. For the kids and the parents who are worried about getting next level and pay, like that's it requires a lot of moving parts working together. Like it requires a lot of folks on the same page that have it requires a lot of that.
Well, and I'm really glad you said the kids and the parents, because the one thing that goes, I think, not talked about enough in all this is it's not just Major League Baseball players who are suffering these arm injuries at higher rates. It's teens, it's college kids, it's guys who are never ever ever going to throw a single pitch in the major leagues
Yep.
Nonetheless, we're going in for ligament replacement surgery at, you know, 17, 16, yeah. 15, 14 years old, where, you know, I'm assuming, and that's, there's, you know, at least Tommy John surgery is not the kind of thing that has lifelong, you know, lasting effects in terms of, you know, it's not like a concussion in football.
But we also don't really know what people's arms are going to be like 30 years from now with a lot of these guys, because there's a whole lot more Tommy John recipients over the last decade. Like, we don't actually know.
For Strider, when he goes under the knife, that'll be his second surgery.
Yep. So, like, we don't really know yet what they're going to be like.
For the Reds, who's going to get his elbow operated on for a third time. Like, we are nearing, I think, and I'd have to double check, but I'm pretty sure we're at the point where we are now seeing professional players who are undergoing their third career Tommy John surgery.
Yeah.
Like, that is terrifying to think about. So it really does have to be. I think it does have to be. If you're going to figure this out and make this a safer sport, at least on that level, to say nothing of what the effects will be on the sport, just how it looks and functions going forward, then it does need. I think you're right. There does need to be a concerted effort from the youth level up to be like, well, how do we make this safer? How do we reorient the focus? So instead of being like, you know, max effort, high spin, you know, that's all you're going to do is, well, let's focus on other things. Let's restrict the usage of breaking balls for young kids. Let's restrict how hard they can throw. Let's focus on, I'm speaking the credo of every high school coach in the country, essentially. Let's focus on the fundamentals. Let's focus on command. Let's focus on control.
Bunting people over. John Taylor famously wants to bunt people over.
Let's focus on TWTW, the will to win.
Yes.
People worry too much about max effort when they should be more worried about max effort.
Hey, John.
Yeah, so take us to another topic. That was...
Hey, John. Clairvoyant John.
Okay.
The Cards, the St. Louis Cardinals, are starting off in last place here.
Yes.
Is that an accurate omen by this time at the end of the year that the Cardinals will end up being a last place team in the NL Central?
It felt a little easier to say this last year because the way that team got off, where it was just very clear early on. It's like, oh no, they don't have any pitching whatsoever.
Yeah.
It's a little different this year. I think already Sonny Gray, who made his St. Louis debut the other day after spending the first few weeks of the season on the injury list because of a hamstring strain, he's going to be better than I think any starter the Cardinals had in their rotation last year.
Yeah.
Lance Lynn, surprisingly, oddly effective. He was pretty good today, even though in pitching through the rain and just Lance Lynn, particularly not the guy with the kind of body who should be wearing what's essentially a see-through uniform. We all need to have a serious talk about that.
We had a blowout with someone sliding this week with the Tigers.
We did. It was Riley Green sliding into home, who tore his pants like basically from the knee up to the hip on one side. Going great with the uniforms in a Major League Baseball. They're really doing good work. I can't believe this is still.
What do you think is annoying Rob Manfred more? The uniform embarrassment or the starting pitching all going down and having to deal with the black eye of the sport of like losing all your arms?
You make it sound like Rob Manfred has any capacity for shame.
Okay.
Rob Manfred doesn't give a shit. He doesn't care. Like did the check clear? Then Manfred's good. He does not care.
Hmm.
The A's thing probably at this point is the most embarrassing, but that one, I think very much in particular, he has just closed his eyes and gone, I pretend I do not see it. for what it's worth, for the Cardinals pitching wise, they're right smack in the middle of the league in ERA, less good, 24th currently in FIP. Mm-hmm. They have not pitched particularly well. And for a team that was undermined completely by the fact that they did not pitch well last year, that has to be concerning. I don't really know that you could expect much. I mean, when you're relying on essentially the quantity over quality rotation of Lynn and Miles Mikolas and Kyle Gibson and Steve Matz, I don't think there's any real reason to expect success out of that. Like you've got guys who are, you know, in terms of FIP, Miles Mikolas is at a 423 mark, Gibson's at 654, Lance Lynn's at 565 before today's start. Matt's at 323. He's got off to a very good start, and Gray obviously has only pitched the one start so far. But they improved. I guess that's the thing with St. Louis. The rotation was improved, but how much was it actually improved? You know what I mean? Like it got better, but not by not a significant amount. Mm-hmm. I think. And then you look offensively at what St. Louis is up to. It's been a struggle for them so far. 288 weighted on base average. That ranks 24th in the majors. Weighted runs created plus, even worse, 79. That ranks 27th. And I think similarly there, when it comes to the Cardinals and what we were expecting this season, I thought a lot of people figured, you know, the pitching should be better, but even if it's not, the offense should be better too. There should be some bounce backs. So far, and again, this is terribly early. We're not above even like 60 plate appearances, I think, for anyone on any roster. No, things have not gone well. Paul Goldschmidt and Nolan Arenado both look ancient. Nolan Gorman still swings at every single thing that gets thrown in his general direction. Jordan Walker still looks rather uncomfortable at the plate. Really, the only guys in this lineup who are hitting on a semi-regular basis, Wilson Contreras, Brendan Donovan, and to a certain degree, Mason Winn. Although Mason Winn, it's purely a slap hitting. There's, you know, two extra base hits and one walk in 37 plate appearances for him. Not what you want, ideally. I mean, he's there primarily for his defense, but still. I think the thing with the Cardinals is they're, you know, so much of this was built on the rotation will have more dependable innings. The lineup will have a resurgence because Arenado and Goldschmidt can't be as bad. Well, what if this is just kind of the beginning of the end for them? Paul Goldschmidt is 36 years old. Arenado is 33.
Around the league are this is the end, because there's going to be a lot of good players moved potentially at the deadline available this summer if it is the end.
And that's kind of the thing. Like, I don't know. There's not necessarily a reason to assume that those guys were just going to, you know, coming off each of them pretty weak offensive seasons, were suddenly a year older going to be like, oh, no, just turn it right back on. That's not normally how this works. If anything, if you were banking on the Cardinals coming back, it was Arenado and Goldschmidt being better, being closer to their regular career selves. Not the case so far.
Yeah.
Gorman and Walker in particular taking a step forward with regards to their plate discipline, with regards to their output, has not happened yet. Obviously, plenty of season left, but we're still seeing the same problems with both of them. It was younger guys like Victor Scott and Wynn and maybe Alec Burleson, who's not necessarily, I mean, he's 25 and he's the oldest guy of the young guys I've mentioned so far, being able to make some kind of, Ivan Herrera, being able to make some kind of impact in some kind of limited space, has not happened so far. There's nothing really here, I think, to make you feel like the Cardinals don't deserve to be where they are. They're 6-7 right now. Based on Pythagorean record, they should be 6-7. This is pretty much where they belong. So I think if you feel like the Cardinals are going to finish last, it's also a matter of, well, who ahead of them can be realistically expected to get worse? Looking at the Fangraphs projected standings, the Cubs are projected now first in the NL Central with 84 wins, then St. Louis at 82, Milwaukee at 82, Pittsburgh at 82, Cincinnati at 80. So there are projections to be worse, but not by any significant amount. There is no, as long as the Pirates keep this up, and they've already made they've buoyed their chances just by getting off to the hot start they've gotten off to. So long as the Pirates are competent, there's no truly bad team in the NL Central. There's no truly good team either. I don't think any of these teams can even will even be approaching pennant contention, much less anything else. But this is not a division where, you know, there's not a White Sox here that everybody gets to beat up on and that you can also feel safe that even if you're amidst the slide, you're like, well, we're not going to be as bad as those guys. So I would put the odds of the Cardinals finishing last in the division at, let's go 25%.
Okay.
That feels fair. Especially because you look at this roster again, you're like, where is the improvement supposed to come from? It's going to have to come from two older guys who are both coming off bad seasons, from younger guys who have yet to show regular competence in the major league level, and from a rotation that would have been bad 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, it's just kind of hard to see where, and this is also not a team with a farm system that's, you know, got, you know, like, four, it's not the Orioles where they've got, oh, well, we just have the number one prospect in baseball sitting here. We're not using him. Okay, bring him on up. You know, that's not how things are going to work in St. Louis. Per Fangraphs, number of Cardinals in the top 100, Wynn and Scott, who are both already up and who are both glove first kind of guys, and then Tink Hentz and Tekoa Roby, who are both starters, maybe could give that rotation a boost somewhere in the middle of the season. More likely than not, I think those are guys they're looking at for next year, which would also probably explain the decision to sign guys like Gibson and Lynn to 1 year contracts, just to help kind of bridge the gap. I kind of feel like when you kind of mull it all through, it does feel like the Cardinals maybe approach this offseason and this season generally as, okay, we don't want to finish last again. But we're also not suddenly going to start signing every free agent under the sun. We don't have the money or the willingness to do that. We have some prospects, but they're still a little bit away and probably not ready to contribute majorly this season. And as you noted, like these contracts, I think Goldschmidt is up. Goldschmidt's contract is up after the end of this season, unless there is an option, which I'm checking. Nope, he is just done after the end of this. This is his last season in St. Louis. And Arenado as well, I think, is pretty close to done. No, he's done in 2027. But he's getting close to the end. And besides, a lot of that is being paid by the Rockies, so I don't really know the Cardinals care all that much. Either way, like this is their last year with Goldschmidt. Maybe there was some thought of like, okay, like 2024 is probably not going to be like, you know, it's the NL Central. Who knows if we're good, just good enough, we might contend. But it's okay if there's probably a thinking in the back of the mind. It's okay if 2024 is kind of a transitional season, you know, to get us a year closer to the prospects, to move on from Goldschmidt's contract, to figure out who of this young group that's currently here might be a part of the future.
This time next year, where is Nolan Arenado and Paul Goldschmidt?
I think that's a big one, too, is to figure out if there's anything left to Arenado, because if there is, great, we ride with him and we'll see what we can get. And if the feeling otherwise is, you know, that there may not be much left to Nolan Arenado, then I think you're right. I think it might be interesting if the Cardinals are still floating around last place or close to it out of a postseason spot by this time in July.
He's the Squidward Yankee meme.
Easily see that is him going to the Yankees, no matter, because even that's the thing, no matter how weak his bat is, the glove remains elite. And I think people will always be betting on a bounce back from Arenado, particularly putting him in a competitive situation like in New York.
Especially when you saw what DJ LeMahieu was before.
Before
the Yankees.
Yeah. So I'm not too optimistic about the Cardinals. I think in particular, because the Pirates being better than expected has wipe out a lot of the kind of like, again, the margin for error they had with regards to a last place team. You know,
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If Pittsburgh were playing like on a 95 loss pace, I'd say, no, there's probably St. Louis is bad, but they're probably not that bad. You know, again, everything projection wise has them looking like a 500 team. But that's kind of the other side of it is 500 may just be last place in the NL Central because every one of those teams might finish somewhere in that 81 to 85 win window. So
I think it requires, like, if it goes that way, is that no one going all pushing more chips in at the deadline between like the Brewers, the Cubs, the Reds and the Pirates.
I mean, I think we can pretty safely bet that the Brewers are not going to go all in at the deadline.
No,
I think we can pretty safely bet that the Pirates will not do so either. I think the Reds are a possibility, but I think they'd have to be pretty well in command of the division to do that. And that pretty much just leaves the Cubs, who I think is the most likely of these teams to do something at the division, because I think they're the most likely to be at the division. I think they're probably the odds on favorite for the division at this point, very early in the season. Mm-hmm. But who knows? Obviously it's the Cubs, it's the Ricketts, you know, they don't do what we think they're going to do. So we shall see.
Final thing here, real quick, 2 minutes, John mm-hmm. Taylor, Steven Strasburg officially retired this past week. Your favorite Steven Strasburg memory, and do you think he's a Hall of Famer?
I'll answer the second one first because it's no. It's just no.
There's no way Strasburg's a Hall of Famer?
I don't think so. If my feeling generally is, unless if you can be a pitching Hall, you can be a Hall of Fame pitcher in one of two ways now at this point. One of those peak durability guys like CC Sabathia, who will be elected whenever, I think he's the first year on the ballot is this coming year. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's a first ballot Hall of Famer, but I think he will get in. kind of the last of that particular breed of like workhorses, mm-hmm. or you have to have like a Pedro Martinez level peak. And to me, Strasburg probably had close to that peak, but the bar in my mind is Johan Santana, who had one of the greatest peaks of any pitcher in Major League history and fell off the Hall of Fame ballot after 1 year.
Yeah.
Which I think it's, I personally think that's a mistake. I don't know if Johan Santana is a Hall of Famer, but I think he deserved a much longer debate and conversation. But in my mind, if
I would create like the Hall of Very Good or the Hall of You Should Remember Player X, it rolls up the tongue. It's very easy, very concise. But like the Johan, the Brad Radke's, the like there's just Hall of like they deserve to not be lost to history. Like even if Strasburg's not a Hall of Famer, he belongs somewhere, man.
He does, but I think that's the thing with the Hall of Fame. If your peak is not as good or high as Johan Santana's, and Strasburg's was not by either the traditional or advanced metrics, you're just not going to get any Hall of Fame consideration. I think Strasburg unfortunately falls into the same Hall of Very Good but not good enough category, and for kind of similar reasons that Tim Lincecum does.
Mm.
I can so
you don't
I,
think Tim gets in either.
No, I don't think there's any chance Tim Lincecum gets.
He just belongs somewhere, though. He was an important part of the 21st century for Major League Baseball.
But this is part of the thing when we're talking about the aesthetics of baseball. Yeah. Like, what do we do with these starters who are undeniably great in our time, but who did not have the longevity and the durability to compare to guys like, you know, even as recent as like Greg Maddux or Tom Glavine, to say nothing of, you know, the stars of the 60s and the 50s and the 30s and the 20s, like. It's all baseball is changing very dramatically in some ways. And I think the pitchers of our era in particular kind of bear the brunt of the kind of negative, you know, maybe not negative is not the right word, but they kind of bear, they're kind of this weird guinea pig for how we're going to look at it. But as the first question, favorite memory, I think it's got to be his debut.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever in my life seen a pitcher that good like that. If you ever,
he's also like the rare guy who just,
he met the hype.
Like that's the other thing is like it's just so easy to overlook now, but so many guys don't go the way Strasburg goes. And was just the prince who was promised. And then he was just exactly that.
And for as much as he got crapped on over the years for his injury history and for a seeming dislike or inability to, you know, to come up big in big moments, he shoved that up everyone's ass in the 2019 postseason.
Yeah,
he went out. So he basically ended his career to win a World Series ring. So
good for him. We love Strasburg.
I love Strasburg. I will never say a bad thing about Steven Strasburg.
Except when he shaved. The clean shave was insane. That was not should have been allowed. I just never do that.
Let me also add shame on the Nationals for dragging this out the way they did.
Yeah,
absolutely no reason to do that. Hopefully, though, the air clears enough that they can have him back so that Washington fans can, especially because they, you know, of all the fan bases, the Nationals guy, I think, screwed hardest by COVID in terms of could not celebrate that World Series in person, could not celebrate the guys who did that. Strasburg obviously was such an instrumental part of that. So I hope he gets his day in the spotlight, even though he doesn't seem to enjoy the spotlight at all. But yeah, I love Strasburg. I'm so sad he's gone, but he gave us some really, really great moments before he left.
There you go. John Taylor. Always a pleasure, my friend, and I'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right, hello. Welcome back to Chase Thomas Podcast, taping this on a Tuesday afternoon. Old friend Dan Matthews, formerly, way back in the day, way back with 680 The Fan. Now back in Houston, Sports Talk 790. Dan, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Oh, man, things are good, Chase. It's great to catch up with you again. Last time, I think we were talking more of the SEC and the Braves, but now back in my hometown of Houston. This is awesome. It's long, and it's nice to, on a daily basis, to talk to a team that I grew up for and that I've been paying attention to for years, even if people have gotten annoyed with my Astros fandom. It says it on my Twitter account. Apologetic. I don't care what you think. And anyway, now I get to talk about a performance too, along with the Rockets and the Texans. Also, things are good, man.
Yeah, I mean the Rockets, right? Playoff push towards the end there, but I mean the Texans going all in. Stefon Diggs and company. It's a good time to be a Houston sports fan. I mean, obviously you're wearing the Houston t-shirt. We'll see with Willie Fritz coming in how he'll do, but he's won everywhere, so I'd probably be pretty optimistic about Willie at Houston. Obviously Kelvin Sampson's done a great job there, but it seems like all things moving in the right direction, even if some fans are maybe a little bit nervous about the Astros start. But I believe the last time they started 4-7, they ended up winning the World Series. So I think I wouldn't hit the panic meter in Houston. What do you think?
No, and you know, thing, I'm one of the rotating hosts we have on Astros on Deck, which is our pregame show, Astros 10th inning, which is our postgame. And I actually laid out the numbers for the Astros Aprils of the last few years. 2019, they at 1-2-5. They ended up winning the AL here and going to the World Series, of course, with Gerrit Cole and with Justin Verlander, later Zach Greinke, and losing to the Washington Nationals. They had a slow 21. They had a slow start in 22. They had a little bit of a slow start last year as well, where the season off pretty decently in their first weekends, where they split the Chicago White Sox, but then they lost four next 10 games, or six of their next 10. They only won four of those games. So April, you know, normally for the Astros has been right around, maybe a little above 500. But as far as it's been pedestrian at best in those, it's usually May, June, and July is when this team's really hit their stride.
So if you had to play devil's advocate in terms of like if there was reason for doom and gloom, I think their run differential is +1 right now, even at 4-7. Like, what would you say is like the most concerning part that if you were to be like, OK, it's time to, this is a real problem here for the rest of the year, what would it be? What would you pinpoint?
I mean, I would say in the immediate, it's probably, you know, the inconsistency of the guys in the back end of the bullpen you thought were going to be your shutdown guys. I mean, you know, Jeter has been off to a little bit of a rocky start. His first couple appearances that he had pretty decent, where, I mean, his first one when it was not a safe situation against the Yankees, he came and struck out the side. Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton included that group. So it was, you know, kind of one of those. As an Astros fan, he came off the mound, you're like, all right, that's why we spent $19 million a year at him. But then, you know, his third appearance of the season was up the go-ahead single to Juan Soto. Second appearance, his first save opportunity, Davis Schneider for Toronto, one homer to put them ahead and eventually win that game. And then the other night when they're up by three against the Rangers, gives up a run there in the ninth, still getting this. But I would say in the immediate, that's it. You know, there were concerns in the beginning about the middle of the bullpen, the middle relief. You know, that's always a group that has guys that make their way onto the team. And a couple of games, it looked like, oh boy, this could be a little bit of an issue. But let's just go back. You know, you mentioned we're recording this on a Tuesday. It's not against the Rangers. You get just a disastrous spot start out of Blair Henley, who was just called up yesterday. And you give the ball to Seth Martinez, who has been an runner's genius. I mean, he has been absolute cooler for opposing offenses. And he comes in, gets a Marcus Semien double play to get out of the inning, leaves it at a 3-run lead for the Rangers. The bats were able to go to work. So he's been a plus. You know, Taylor Scott, the South African player in the major leagues has been a real plus, and the Astros were able to piece it together last night. So I would say that, you know, starting pitching, even with the injuries to Justin Verlander and Jose Urquidy. And now, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Frondez. They don't seem concerned, but I would be pretty shocked if not a precautionary, let's shut you down for a starts. Maybe that's an IL, and it happens. It'll be interesting to see if they break the glass. Our top pitching prospect, Spencer Arrighetti, showed some good things during the spring. But, I mean, pitching, you know, is what wins in this league. And part of it as well is the part that I think probably gets the benefit of the doubt with the Astros. Bregman's been off to a slow start. Up until a couple of games ago, Yordan had been off to a slow start. But seeing it the last couple of games, when he's Yordan, this offense moves. And he has been Yordan these past couple of games. Oddly enough, they won those last games. So it shows you what he can mean offense.
It's funny, like when you think about in terms of like managerial impact, a lot of it comes up in playoff time. It's where you really start to notice like those pressure cooker moments and navigating when to go to the bullpen, when to let guys get through the third time through the order, like having a good feel. Like that's when the managers really make their money and earn their keep. So it's going to take some time to figure out what Joe Espada is ultimately going to bring Houston. In terms of like the first 10 or so games, what have you noticed that's different that he's bringing? Is there something that he's doing with the lineup that's a little bit different? The way he's managing the bullpen is different than Dusty Baker. What are some early differences that you've noticed the way he's going to be coaching this team versus what Dusty has the last few years?
I would say the lineup is one. I mean, he's very much like Dusty, where continuity is the name of the game. I mean, keep those guys in, keep them going. You know, the guys that are struggling, get them going. I mean, you know, early on, I was even one of the ones who maybe the Yordan Alvarez in the two spot is working for this team. Maybe you need to bump him down. Maybe that's an Alex Bregman spot and you can get them going. But credit to him, you know, he has said exactly like what was like of continuity of no, he's too good of a hitter. We like him in that spot. Also know, you know, new age Major League Baseball, the two spot in the order now is your power guy. I mean, that you want. That's why it's so imperative. Bottom of your order really gets things going. It has been pretty much a bright spot with Jeremy and also Jake Meyer there in the bottom of the order. I mean, you saw it the other night, Sunday Baseball. Jake Meyer works a walk, gets on base. Jose Altuve works a walk, gets on base. And then Yordan Alvarez hits one that got out of the park in about a millisecond where, you know, ESPN at the time was interviewing Carter out in left field. And all Carter could do was disbelief of, wow, that ball really got off his bat. But I would say it's that. I mean, you know, in terms of everything, I mean, fans are going to be fans. And we've seen it. I mean, when I was in Atlanta, people did the same thing with Brian Snitker. I feel like that baseball managers are a lot like offensive coordinators in college and NFL football, where nobody remember the really great calls. It's going to be the to get the credit for that. But if you call one that completely backfires on you, a triple, you know, a screen pass on third, something like that, and it just gets blown up, then you idiot. I can't believe you did that, you know, for the most part. You know, it's really been execution of his decisions by the plus that has not worked out. I mean, early on season, like I said, you know, Brian Abreu, you put him in the spot that he's supposed to be put in the seventh inning game against the Yankees, and he doesn't do his job. He walks a couple of, gives up a couple of home runs and surrenders the lead. You know, same deal with Ryan Pressly. I mean, Pressly knew coming into the season, he was not going to be the closer anymore. He was going to have to go back the spot that he was in when he first got here, and Roberto's the closer of this team as a setup guy. And eventually he became closer of this team and became a really good one. But, you know, he has not really executed. Sunday night had a good scoreless inning. That was good to see. And, you know, same deal with Josh Hader. He hasn't been the we thought Josh Hader would be, at least in the early going. Now, we've seen closers early on in the season struggle in the past. That's not an unusual thing, but they – more than anything, I don't put blame Espada for the slow start. I put blame on guys that you've been needing to count on to get things done and doing it. I mean, that first series against the Yankees, Chase, they went 8-41 with runners in scoring, and they went 4. And they had an all offensive game. No, it's not at all. And you know, they had an awful defensive game in game two where you know, you had miscue by Jeremy Pena on a throw to Jose Bay, and then Parker Mushinski on a swing bunt, throwing one up the right field line. You know, so I mean, I just think that been a little bit of player just not executing early on in the season, but I think you're starting to see them turn the corner. I mean, last night, you know, I talk about a little bit later on the A team 3-6. weekdays on Sports Talk 790, Adam Clanton and Adam, of just, you know, what that game meant for them tonight. Of, you know, they haven't won a game like that season. It's seemingly if they've had a lead and they've lead, then the bats have gone quiet. They haven't been able to turn things around. But last night, you know, I mentioned Yordan. It seems like when he gets offense goes, and when he hit that two-run homer in the second inning, I think that it was a little bit of, hey, we can breathe. We're good. You know, we're only down by one now. And then he tied him, and then Kyle Tucker knocked in two runs, and Victor Caratini hit a three-run homer to put it ahead for good at 10-5 on to that lead. But I would say that guys that you need to count on not executing early on has been the issue. It hasn't been Joe Espada.
Yeah, and I wonder too, I mean, when you talk about Bregman's slow start, was that expected? Is that something that you think lingers going into the season? Is there, I mean, the other part of it is, I guess, with John and I, formerly of Fangraphs, where we talk on our MLB show every week, was just that, like, the Astros have kind of just, they have a, it's similar to the Braves in a lot of ways, where, like, it's just been kind of understood that, like, Max Fried was not going to be back after this year. Like, he's going to play it out. That's just not how the Braves do business. Like, enjoy it, but this is just kind of, if they don't lock these guys in when they're super young, that probably means they're going to play it out. So Carlos Correa, you kind of knew was not long for the Astros, but then you lock up Altuve. It was like they were going to keep someone to keep this thing humming, but now that you picked Altuve, does it seem like this is it for Bregman, no matter what he does this year for Houston?
Well, I mean, we'll start with the first part of that question. I mean, Aprils have been a start for Bregman in the past. You know, yesterday, Adam Wexler, one of our hosts, for the numbers of his OPS batting average for the season last year, I think he was like 219 and like a 5-something OPS, not the greatest of April. And then May, June, and July, when he became Alex Bregman of, you know, 20-30 home runs and being an on-base guy, somebody that you could count on. But, you know, I would be lying, Chase, if, you know, he ever admit this. But I've got to wonder if maybe the start is a little bit of putting a little bit of added pressure on him. Because, you know, I think that we can all see what happened with Scott Boras this offseason. And Bregman's going to be one of those that if they go to free agency, we'll see if it gets to that point. I mean, Dana Brown, Astros GM, formerly of the Braves, has said on numerous occasions there will be an offer made, and we'll see what happens from Bregman and Boras camp on that. But, I mean, when you're in a contract year, there's that pressure, even if you admit it, that's there. And, you know, I think, you know, maybe that's feeding into a little bit of sing at the plate. You know, defensively, what he's always been. He's been fantastic over at, you expect nothing less of him there. That's always going to be consistent with Alex Bregman. But, you know, in terms of long-term with him, I mean, I think it's interesting. You know, the Astros will have some money in season. More than likely, this is the end of the line for Justin Verlander. But, you know, then that comes in the question is, I think you probably believe that you're going to make a strong run at either him or a guy that's a year after him in Kyle Tucker. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people who wonder from clubhouse leadership perspective and continuity, if it's better for Bregman or if you want to, in my opinion, I think if you're going to say, hey, you get to pick one of the other. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think when it comes down to it, if you're choosing between one of the other guys, I mean, I go Tucker. I just think that the age, he's younger. You know, what he gives you in terms of the tools perspective as well of the speed, the power, the arm, the glove that you get with him out in the outfield. I would wonder if the Astros would be willing to go that route over Bregman. I mean, people have been throwing out $300 million with Bregman. I don't think that the batting numbers are there for that. I think they're kidding themselves. I think that probably what he would be hoping for in that regard is he's really able to get this season going, and that a team like the Red Sox or somebody hops in and throws a bunch of money at him. But I mean, you know, they've also got Rafael Devers over there. So I don't know if that's you kick Bregman over to short or, you know, how that works there. But the thought process is from people I've talked with is that this is the end for Bregman. But then it's also two other people I talk with say, well, hold on now. You know, this is where Jim Crane gets involved. And when Jim Crane wants guys back, he says, hey, I'll open up the pocketbook. I'll spend the money. I want that guy back. And so that's going to be interesting to see if that plays out towards the end of the season.
I love it. As we look to, you know, this weekend here, Dan, your LSU Tigers, they come into a hornet's nest that is Knoxville, Tennessee. Tennessee, a top five team once again this year. This was a game that, I mean, if you looked at tickets like a month ago, and I don't know where it is at this point, but it was like in the 300 for like the cheapest seat for Tennessee LSU. They've been two big rivals. Obviously, they played last year in postseason ball, and Paul Skeens was unbelievable. And it was hard, and Tennessee could not get over the LSU hump, and nobody could because LSU won the national title. But when you look at this year, what's different about this LSU baseball team? Why do you think they're struggling so much in conference play? And what excites you most about this this matchup with Tennessee over the weekend?
Well, I think the difference is you hit it right on the head. I mean, you lose a guy like Paul Skeens, you don't just replace that. And I know early on in the season they were able to get decent enough pitching, but you know, you had your opening Friday starter Thatcher Hurd get off to a little bit of a slow start, and really the pitching as a whole has not been able to get on track this season. But you know, it kind of has also been, you know, a Jay Johnson team ever since he's been at LSU, and even when he was at Arizona, of teams that will mash. They can absolutely put the ball over the fence, and LSU is still able to do that with Tommy White, Hayden Stravinsky in the middle of that order. But the problem has been being able to keep guys off base and not extending innings. And that's been a real issue. But I mean, you know, LSU is a team that really needs to have a good series in conference play. It was a disaster when they went to Mississippi State. It was a disaster against Arkansas on the road. And also too, last weekend after the opening win against Vanderbilt, you thought, well, maybe things will turn around and you know, they're on the right track now, and hopefully you can take two out of three from these guys. And the bottom completely fell out. I mean, Vanderbilt able to get better pitching than LSU was and able to win that Friday and Saturday game. But no, I mean, you know, you go into Tennessee, a place that is very tough to win. They found that out in the Super Regional a couple of years ago in Paul Maneri's final series as the manager of LSU. And, you know, it is a fan base that seems like everybody I've talked with when they played there at Lindsey Nelson Stadium, they're right on top of you. I mean, you know, it's you almost feel like the guys talking the most trash are right in your dugout with you, talking it to you. So it's tough. And, you know, Tennessee, too. I mean, you talk about a team that seemingly just has MF-er in them. And that starts from the top. I mean, you got a head coach like, you know, Tony Vitello, who runs the way he does. The team kind of feeds off of it. And, you know, they play with that fire at all times. And, you know, I think for a team like Tennessee, you're right. I mean, LSU ended their season last year. So, you know, I think that probably for the guys that were on that team that were in Omaha facing them, say, hey, you know, let's return the favor. You know, these guys are kind of on the fence right now in terms of the SEC standings. And, you know, if we can really knock them off even further and put them on that first day of the SEC tournament, that puts them in jeopardy of even being able to make the regionals at the end of the season. So that's going to be motivation in itself. But LSU, if they want to get this thing on track, they've got to get better pitching. They have just not been able to get that group going. And you've seen it. I mean, like I said, you know, last week, you know, losing at Arkansas before the Vanderbilt series. And then they turned right around that Monday for a midweek game and lost to Southern at home. I mean, you know, this is a team that I think is kind of reeling a little bit. And, you know, you think about it. I mean, they still have a ton of talent. And this reminds me so much of Jay Johnson's first team, where you saw talent, but you also knew there's some things missing from this team. And pitching is one of those things. And, you know, we've seen that Jay Johnson is very much he will raid the transfer portal. I would be shocked and surprised if he didn't do that again, of trying to find another version of Paul Skeens this offseason, or maybe even two or three guys to come in and try to lift this group. But, you know, like I said, the talent is there. It's just, you know, the small things that they had at the end of last season, you know, having Paul Skeens, you know, having the pitching that they had in the back end of Ackenhausen and, you know, just a lot of the guys that are still there, but, you know, still not able to get, you know, in the rhythm that they were last season. I think that's a huge issue. So it's a huge series for both teams. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And, you know, the beauty of the SEC is you've got so many good teams. The curse of the SEC is you got so many good teams that, you know, you're not going out there one week and saying, hey, we're facing Vanderbilt. And then, oh, we're facing a team we should be able to sweep or at least take two out of three from. It's a battle every single week, and they know that.
No, I mean, it's going to be a thing. And I mean, they've circled this one, and you talk about the Hornets' Nest and the fans on top of you. Like, it's going to be – the weather's good this weekend in Knoxville. It's Masters weekend. Orange and white game is Saturday for Tennessee. It's going to be a party atmosphere, and it's going to be something that I don't think – LSU – I mean, you saw over the weekend, Tennessee run rules Auburn on the road. And I mean, home teams have just dominated in SEC play through the first month of the season, where you just look at it like it's unbelievably difficult to win two out of three on the road, especially even sweep. And I mean, Kentucky out of nowhere has been one of the best teams in SEC play. And we'll see, because Tennessee goes there actually next weekend at Kentucky. And they've had problems there 2 years ago. I think it was their only SEC series loss with that number one team was actually going to Kentucky in the cold. But we'll see. I think it's gonna be fun and standing room only, and it's gonna be a fun college baseball weekend series, because I don't think there's any love lost between these two programs right now. And Tennessee wants to continue to prove themselves. The hitting is, I think, actually better than what it was, deeper than 2 years ago. And you get Billy Amick back, who Tennessee still ranked, with Billy Amick being away with injury for the last week and a half. So it'll be fun. But Dan Matthews, where can the good folks listen to you each and every day in Houston?
Yeah, so download the iHeartRadio app. It's free. That is the beauty of it. So you can download it, find Sports Talk 790 on there. Of course, listen to our show, The A-Team, Adam Clanton, Adam Wexler, 3 to 6 weekdays there on Sports Talk 790. We've also got the Sean Salisbury show. People know Sean, of course, from his work in the NFL, and also, too, on ESPN. Stan Norfleet, a guy that used to work in Atlanta as well, from 10 to noon with our good buddy Chris Gordy of Locked On SEC. And then the Matt Thomas show from noon to three. And, of course, too, we are the home of the Astros and the Rockets and the Texas Longhorns for football and basketball in the city of Houston. So you've got all that. So, again, download the Sports Talk 790 app, and you can catch me, my show, on Saturday mornings, 10 to noon, Space City Saturday, coming your way there. And also, to me with Astros pre and post with Astros on deck and Astros 10th inning coming your way there as well. So we got it all.
There you go. I love it. Josh Dobbs needs to, like, that needs to be his final spot with Miss Astro and everything else. Dobbs has to find his way to Houston at some point.
I was gonna say, maybe, you know, because, I mean, we feel pretty good about CJ Stroud right now. But yeah, I mean, I think that with, you know, his aeronautics degree that he's got there, that probably, you know, if Davis Mills ever moves on, that Joshua Dobbs needs to find his way backing up CJ Stroud here in Houston. And I mean, if he wants an internship with NASA, it's right up the road. So
yeah,
I think it would work out incredibly well.
I love it. Dan, keep up the great work, sir. And we'll have to check back in again soon.
Absolutely, Chase. It's always great to catch up with you, and make sure Hoyt's being nice to you. You know, as we knew from my time with Sports Talk, with 680 The Fan, Hoyt can, he can be tough on people.
Who knows where Hoyt is these days, though? The guy disappeared. Who knows? Like, who knows? But, you know, I talked to Matt on the pod a few weeks ago. Matt's good. You know, everyone's fine. Like, hey, it is what it is. So they'll be okay. And Hoyt will be back at some point, I'm sure. We'll see, though. Dan, thank you so much for the time, and I'll talk to you again soon.